No words were exchanged with Robbie, not a glance in his direction. He was now staring into the water. And then he too was striding away, no doubt satisfied, round the side of the house. Suddenly the scene was empty. The wet patch on the ground, where Cecilia had got out of the pond, was the only evidence that anything had happened at all. Bryony leaned back against a wall and stared unseeingly down the nursery's length. It was a temptation for her to be magical and dramatic, and to regard what she had witnessed as a tableau mounted for her alone, a special moral for her wrapped in a mystery. But she knew very well that if she had not stood when she did, the scene would still have happened, for it was not about her at all. Only chance had brought her to the window. This was not a fairy tale, this was real. The adult world in which frogs did not address princesses, and the only messages were the ones that people sent. It was also a temptation to run to Cecilia's room and demand an explanation. Bryony resisted because she wanted to chase in solitude the faint thrill of possibility she had felt before, the elusive excitement at a prospect she was coming close to defining, at least emotionally. The definition would refine itself over the years. She was to concede that she may have attributed more deliberation than was feasible to her 13-year-old self. At the time, there may have been no precise form of words. In fact, she may have experienced nothing more than impatience to begin writing again. As she stood in the nursery, waiting for her cousin's return, she sensed she could write a scene like the one by the fountain, and she could include a hidden observer like herself. She could imagine herself hurrying down now to her bedroom, to a clean block of lined paper and her marbled, Bakelite fountain pen. She could see the simple sentences, the accumulating telepathic symbols unfurling at the nib's end. She could write the scene three times over, from three points of view. Her excitement was in the prospect of freedom, of being delivered from the cumbrous struggle between good and bad, heroes and villains. None of these three was bad, nor were they particularly good. She need not judge. There did not have to be a moral. She need only show separate minds, as alive as her own, struggling with the idea that other minds were equally alive. It wasn't only wickedness and scheming that made people unhappy, it was confusion and misunderstanding. Above all, it was the failure to grasp the simple truth that other people are as real as you. And only in a story could you enter these different minds and show how they had an equal value. That was the only moral a story need have. 6 decades later, she would describe how at the age of 13, she had written her way through a whole history of literature, beginning with stories derived from the European tradition of folk tales, through drama with simple moral intent, to arrive at an impartial psychological realism which she had discovered for herself, one special morning during a heatwave in 1935. She would be well aware of the extent of her self-mythologizing, and she gave her account a self-mocking or mock-heroic tone. Her fiction was known for its amorality, and like all authors pressed by a repeated question, she felt obliged to produce a storyline, a plot of her development that contained the moment when she became recognisably herself. She knew that it was not correct to refer to her dramas in the plural, that her mockery distanced her from the earnest, reflective child, and that it was not the long-ago morning she was recalling so much as her subsequent accounts of it. It was possible that the contemplation of a crooked finger, the unbearable idea of other minds and the superiority of stories over plays, were thoughts she had had on other days. She also knew that whatever actually happened drew its significance from her published work and would not have been remembered without it. However, she could not betray herself completely. There could be no doubt that some kind of revelation occurred. When the young girl went back to the window and looked down, the damp patch on the gravel had evaporated. Now there was nothing left of the dumb show by the fountain beyond what survived in memory, in three separate and overlapping memories. The truth had become as ghostly as invention. She could begin now, setting it down as she had seen it, meeting the challenge by refusing to condemn her sister's shocking near-nakedness in daylight right by the house. Then the scene could be recast through Cecilia's eyes and then Robbie's. But now was not the time to begin. Bryony's sense of obligation, as well as her instinct for order, was powerful. She must complete what she had initiated. There was a rehearsal in progress. Leon was on his way. The household was expecting a performance tonight. She should go down once more to the laundry to see whether the trials of Jackson were at an end. The writing could wait until she was free. Chapter 4. It was not until the late afternoon that Cecilia judged the vase repaired. It had baked all afternoon on a table by a south-facing window in the library, and now three fine meandering lines in the glaze, converging like rivers in an atlas, were all that showed. No one would ever know. As she crossed the library with the vase in both hands, she heard what she thought was the sound of bare feet on the hallway tiles outside the library door. Having passed many hours deliberately not thinking about Robbie Turner, she was outraged that he should be back in the house once again without his socks. She stepped out into the hallway, determined to face down his insolence or his mockery, and was confronted instead by her sister, clearly in distress. Her eyelids were swollen and pink, and she was pinching on her lower lip with forefinger and thumb, an old sign with Bryony that some serious weeping was to be done. "Darling, what's up?" Her eyes, in fact, were dry, and they lowered fractionally to take in the vase. Then she pushed on past to where the easel stood supporting the poster with the merry, multicoloured title and a Chagall-like montage of highlights from her play in watercolour scattered around the lettering. The tearful parents waving, the moonlit ride to the coast, the heroine on her sickbed, a wedding. She paused before it, and then with one violent diagonal stroke, ripped away more than half of it and let it fall to the floor. Cecilia put the vase down and hurried over and knelt down to retrieve the fragment before her sister began to trample on it. This would not be the first time she had rescued Bryony from self-destruction. "Little sis, is it the cousins?" She wanted to comfort her sister, for Cecilia had always loved to cuddle the baby of the family. When she was small and prone to nightmares, those terrible screams in the night, Cecilia used to go to her room and wake her. "Come back," she used to whisper. "It's only a dream. Come back." And then she would carry her into her own bed. She wanted to put her arm round Bryony's shoulder now, but she was no longer tugging on her lip and had moved away to the front door and was resting one hand on the great brass lion's head handle that Mrs. Turner had polished that afternoon. "The cousins are stupid, but it's not only that, it's..." She trailed away, doubtful whether she should confide her recent revelation. Cecilia smoothed the jagged triangle of paper and thought how her little sister was changing. It would have suited her better had Bryony wept and allowed herself to be comforted on the silk chaise longue in the drawing room. Such stroking and soothing murmurs would have been a release for Cecilia after a frustrating day whose various cross-currents of feeling she had preferred not to examine. Addressing Bryony's problems with kind words and caresses would have restored a sense of control. However, there was an element of autonomy in the younger girl's unhappiness. She had turned her back and was opening the door wide. "But what is it, then?" Cecilia could hear the neediness in her own voice. Beyond her sister, far beyond the lake, the driveway curved across the park, narrowed and converged over rising ground, to a point where a tiny shape, made formless by the warping heat, was growing, and then flickered and seemed to recede. It would be Hardman, who said he was too old to learn to drive a car, bringing the visitors in the trap. Bryony changed her mind and faced her sister.
"The whole thing's a mistake. It's the wrong..."
She snatched a breath and glanced away, a signal Cecilia sensed of a dictionary word about to have its first outing.
"It's the wrong Jean."
She pronounced genre as she thought, in the French way, monosyllabically, but without quite getting her tongue round the R.
"Jean?" Cecilia called after her. "What are you talking about?"
But Bryony was hobbling away on soft white soles across the fiery gravel. Cecilia went to the kitchen to fill the vase and carried it up to her bedroom to retrieve the flowers from the hand basin. When she dropped them in, they once again refused to fall into the artful disorder she preferred, and instead swung round in the water into a wilful neatness, with the taller stalks evenly distributed around the rim. She lifted the flowers and let them drop again, and they fell into another orderly pattern. Still, it hardly mattered. It was difficult to imagine this Mr. Marshall complaining that the flowers by his bedside were too symmetrically displayed. She took the arrangement up to the second floor, along the creaking corridor to what was known as Auntie Venus's room, and set the vase on a chest of drawers by a four-poster bed, thus completing the little commission her mother had set her that morning 8 hours before. However, she did not immediately leave, for the room was pleasingly uncluttered by personal possessions. In fact, apart from Bryony's, it was the only tidy bedroom. And it was cool here, now that the sun had moved round the house. Every drawer was empty, every bare surface without so much as a fingerprint. Under the chintz counterpane, the sheets would be starchily pure. She had an impulse to slip her hand between the covers to feel them, but instead she moved deeper into Mr. Marshall's room. At the foot of the four-poster, the seat of a Chippendale sofa had been so carefully straightened that sitting down would have seemed a desecration. The air was smooth with the scent of wax, and in the honeyed light, the gleaming surfaces of the furniture seemed to ripple and breathe. As her approach altered her angle of view, the revellers on the lid of an ancient trousseau chest writhed into dance steps. Mrs. Turner must have passed through that morning. Cecilia shrugged away the association with Robbie. Being here was a kind of trespass, with the room's future occupant just a few hundred yards away from the house. From where she had arrived by the window, she could see that Bryony had crossed the bridge to the island and was walking down the grassy bank and beginning to disappear among the lakeshore trees that surrounded the island temple. Further off, Cecilia could just make out the two hatted figures sitting up on the bench behind Hardman. Now she saw a third figure, whom she had not noticed before, striding along the driveway toward the trap. Surely it was Robbie Turner on his way home. He stopped, and as the visitors approached, his outline seemed to fuse with that of the visitors. She could imagine the scene, the manly punches to the shoulder, the horseplay. She was annoyed that her brother could not know that Robbie was in disgrace, and she turned from the window with a sound of exasperation and set off for her room in search of a cigarette. She had one packet remaining, and only after several minutes of irritable raking through her mess did she find it in the pocket of a blue silk dressing gown on her bathroom floor. She lit up as she descended the stairs to the hall, knowing that she would not have dared had her father been at home. He had precise ideas about where and when a woman should be seen smoking. Not in the street or any other public place, not on entering a room, not standing up, and only when offered, never from her own supply. Notions as self-evident to him as natural justice. 3 years among the sophisticates of Girton had not provided her with the courage to confront him. The light-hearted ironies she might have deployed among her friends deserted her in his presence,
and she heard her own voice become thin when she attempted some docile contradiction. In fact, being at odds with her father about anything at all, even an insignificant domestic detail, made her uncomfortable, and nothing that great literature might have done to modify her sensibilities, none of the lessons of practical criticism, could quite deliver her from obedience. Smoking on the stairway when her father was installed in his Whitehall ministry was all the revolt her education would allow, and still it cost her some effort. As she reached the broad landing that dominated the hallway, Leon was showing Paul Marshall through the wide-open front entrance. Danny Hardman was behind them with their luggage. Old Hardman was just in view outside, gazing mutely at the £5 note in his hand. The indirect afternoon light, reflected from the gravel and filtered through the fanlight, filled the entrance hall with the yellowish-orange tones of a sepia print. The men had removed their hats and stood waiting for her, smiling. Cecilia wondered, as she sometimes did when she met a man for the first time, if this was the one she was going to marry, and whether it was this particular moment she would remember for the rest of her life, with gratitude or profound and particular regret. "Sis, Celia," Leon called. When they embraced, she felt against her collarbone through the fabric of his jacket a thick fountain pen and smelled pipe smoke in the folds of his clothes, prompting a moment's nostalgia for afternoon tea visits to rooms in men's colleges, rather polite and anodyne occasions mostly, but cheery too, especially in winter. Paul Marshall shook her hand and made a faint bow. There was something comically brooding about his face. His opener was conventionally dull. "I've heard an awful lot about you." "And me you." What she could remember was a telephone conversation with her brother some months before, during which they had discussed whether they had ever eaten, or would ever eat, an ammo bar. "Emily's lying down." It was hardly necessary to say it. As children, they claimed to be able to tell from across the far side of the park whenever their mother had a migraine by a certain darkening at the windows. "And the old man staying in town?" "He might come later." Cecilia was aware that Paul Marshall was staring at her, but before she could look at him, she needed to prepare something to say. "The children were putting on a play, but it rather looks like it's fallen apart." Marshall said, "That might have been your sister I saw down by the lake. She was giving the nettles a good thrashing." Leon stepped aside to let Hardman's boy through with the bags. "Where are we putting Paul?" "On the second floor." Cecilia had inclined her head to direct these words at the young Hardman. He had reached the foot of the stairs and now stopped and turned, a leather suitcase in each hand, to face them where they were grouped in the centre of the checkered, tiled expanse. His expression was of tranquil incomprehension. She had noticed him hanging around the children lately. Perhaps he was interested in Lola. He was 16, and certainly no boy. The roundness she remembered in his cheeks had gone, and the childish bow of his lips had become elongated and innocently cruel. Across his brow, a constellation of acne had a new minted look, its garishness softened by the sepia light. All day long, she realized, she had been feeling strange, and seeing strangely, as though everything was already long in the past, made more vivid by posthumous ironies she could not quite grasp. She said to him patiently, "The big room past the nursery." "Auntie Venus's room," Leon said. Auntie Venus had been for almost half a century a vital nursing presence across a swathe of the Northern Territories and Canada. She was no one's aunt particularly, or rather she was Mr. Tallis's dead second cousin's aunt, but no one questioned her right, after her retirement, to the room on the second floor, where, for most of their childhoods, she had been a sweet-natured, bedridden invalid who withered away to an uncomplaining death when Cecilia was 10. A week later, Bryony was born. Cecilia led the visitors into the drawing room, through the French windows, past the roses, toward the swimming pool, which was behind the stable block and was surrounded on four sides by a high thicket of bamboo, with a tunnel-like gap for an entrance. They walked through, bending their heads under low canes, and emerged onto a terrace of dazzling white stone from which the heat rose in a blast. In deep shadow, set well back from the water's edge, was a white-painted tin table with a pitcher of iced punch under a square of cheesecloth. Leon unfolded the canvas chairs, and they sat with their glasses in a shallow circle facing the pool. From his position between Leon and Cecilia, Marshall took control of the conversation with a 10-minute monologue. He told them how wonderful it was to be away from town, in tranquility, in the country air. For 9 months, for every waking minute of every day, enslaved to a vision, he had shuttled between headquarters, his boardroom, and the factory floor. He had bought a large house on Clapham Common and hardly had time to visit it. The launch of Rainbow Ammo had been a triumph, but only after various distribution catastrophes, which had now been set right. The advertising campaign had offended some elderly bishops, so another was devised. Then came the problems of success itself: unbelievable sales, new production quotas, and disputes about overtime rates, and the search for a site for a second factory, about which the four unions involved had been generally sullen and had needed to be charmed and coaxed like children. And now, when all had been brought to fruition, there loomed the greater challenge yet of army ammo, the khaki bar with the Pass the Ammo slogan. The concept rested on an assumption that spending on the armed forces must go on increasing if Mr. Hitler did not pipe down. There was even a chance that the bar could become part of the standard-issue ration pack. In that case, if there were to be a general conscription, a further five factories would be needed. There were some on the board who were convinced there should and would be an accommodation with Germany, and that army ammo was a dead duck. One member was even accusing Marshall of being a warmonger. But exhausted as he was and maligned, he would not be turned away from his purpose, his vision. He ended by repeating that it was wonderful to find oneself way out here, where one could, as it were, catch one's breath. Watching him during the first several minutes of his delivery, Cecilia felt a pleasant sinking sensation in her stomach as she contemplated how deliciously self-destructive it would be, almost erotic, to be married to a man so nearly handsome, so hugely rich, so unfathomably stupid. He would fill her with his big-faced children, all of them loud, bone-headed boys with a passion for guns and football and aeroplanes. She watched him in profile as he turned his head toward Leon. A long muscle twitched above the line of his jaw as he spoke. A few thick black hairs curled free of his eyebrow, and from his ear holes there sprouted the same black growth, comically kinked like pubic hair. He should instruct his barber. The smallest shift in her gaze brought her Leon's face, but he was staring politely at his friend and seemed determined not to meet her eye. As children, they used to torment each other with the look at the Sunday lunches their parents gave for elderly relatives. These were awesome occasions, worthy of the ancient silver service. The venerable great-uncles and aunts and grandparents were Victorians from their mother's side of the family, a baffled and severe folk, a lost tribe who arrived at the house in black cloaks, having wandered peevishly for two decades in an alien, frivolous century. They terrified the 10-year-old Cecilia and her 12-year-old brother, and a giggling fit was always just a breath away. The one who caught the look was helpless, the one who bestowed it, immune. Mostly, the power was with Leon, whose look was mock solemn, and consisted of drawing the corners of his mouth downward while rolling his eyes. He might ask Cecilia in the most innocent voice for the salt to be passed, and though she averted her gaze as she handed it to him, Though she turned her head and inhaled deeply, it could be enough simply to know that he was doing his look to consign her to 90 minutes of quaking torture. Meanwhile, Leon would be free, needing only to top her up occasionally if he thought she was beginning to recover. Only rarely had she reduced him with an expression of haughty pouting. Since the children were sometimes seated between adults, giving the look had its dangers. Making faces at table could bring down disgrace and an early bedtime. The trick was to make the attempt while passing between, say, licking one's lips and smiling broadly, and at the same time catch the other's eye. On one occasion, they had looked up and delivered their looks simultaneously, causing Leon to spray soup from his nostrils onto the wrist of a great aunt. Both children were banished to their rooms for the rest of the day. Cecilia longed to take her brother aside and tell him that Mr. Marshall had pubic hair growing from his ears. He was describing the boardroom confrontation with the man who called him a warmonger. She half raised her arm as though to smooth her hair. Automatically, Leon's attention was drawn by the motion, and in that instant she delivered the look he had not seen in more than 10 years. He pursed his lips and turned away, and found something of interest to stare at near his shoe. As Marshall turned to Cecilia, Leon raised a cupped hand to shield his face, but could not disguise from his sister the tremor along his shoulders. Fortunately for him, Marshall was reaching his conclusion. Where one can, as it were, catch one's breath. Immediately Leon was on his feet. He walked to the edge of the pool and contemplated a sodden red towel left near the diving board. Then he strolled back to them, hands in pockets, quite recovered. He said to Cecilia, "Guess who we met on the way in?" "Robbie. I told him to join us tonight." "Leon, you didn't." He was in a teasing mood. Revenge, perhaps. He said to his friend, "So the cleaning lady's son gets a scholarship to the local grammar, gets a scholarship to Cambridge, goes up the same time as C, and she hardly speaks to him in 3 years. She wouldn't let him near her Rodine chums. You should have asked me first." She was genuinely annoyed, and observing this, Marshall said placatingly, "I knew some grammar school types at Oxford, and some of them were damn clever. But they could be resentful, which was a bit rich, I thought." She said, "Have you got a cigarette?" He offered her one from a silver case, threw one to Leon, and took one for himself. They were all standing now, and as Cecilia leaned toward Marshall's lighter, Leon said, "He's got a first-rate mind, so I don't know what the hell he's doing messing about in the flower beds." She went to sit on the diving board and tried to give the appearance of relaxing, but her tone was strained. "He's wondering about a medical degree. Leon, I wish you hadn't asked him." "The old man said yes." She shrugged. "Look, I think you ought to go round to the bungalow now and ask him not to come." Leon had walked to the shallow end and stood facing her across the gently rocking sheet of oily blue water. "How can I possibly do that?" "I don't care how you do it. Make an excuse." "Something's happened between you." "No, it hasn't." "Is he bothering you?" "For God's sake." She got up irritably and walked away toward the swimming pool pavilion, an open structure supported by 3 fluted pillars. She stood, leaning against the central pillar, smoking and watching her brother. 2 minutes before, they had been in league, and now they were at odds. Childhood revisited indeed. Paul Marshall stood halfway between them, turning his head this way and that when they spoke, as though at a tennis match. He had a neutral, vaguely inquisitive air and seemed untroubled by this sibling squabble. That, at least, Cecilia thought, was in his favour. Her brother said, "You think he can't hold a knife and fork?" Leon, stop it. You had no business inviting him.
What rot!
The silence that followed was partly mitigated by the drone of the filtration pump. There was nothing she could do, nothing she could make Leon do, and she suddenly felt the pointlessness of argument. She lolled against the warm stone, lazily finishing her cigarette and contemplating the scene before her. The foreshortened slab of chlorinated water, the black inner tube of a tractor tire propped against a deck chair, the two men in cream linen suits of infinitesimally different hues, bluish-grey smoke rising against the bamboo green. It looked carved, fixed, and again she felt it. It had happened a long time ago, and all outcomes, on all scales, from the tiniest to the most colossal, were already in place. Whatever happened in the future, however superficially strange or shocking, would also have an unsurprising, familiar quality, inviting her to say, but only to herself, "Oh yes, of course, that. I should have known." She said lightly, "Do you know what I think?"
"What's that?"
"We should go indoors, and you should mix us a fancy kind of drink." Paul Marshall banged his hands together, and the sound ricocheted between the columns and the back wall of the pavilion.
"There's something I do rather well," he called, "with crushed ice, rum, and melted dark chocolate."
The suggestion prompted an exchange of glances between Cecilia and her brother, and thus their discord was resolved. Leon was already moving away, and as Cecilia and Paul Marshall followed him and converged on the gap in the thicket, she said, "I'd rather have something bitter, or even sour." He smiled, and since he had reached the gap first, he paused to hand her through, as though it were a drawing-room doorway, and as she passed, she felt him touch her lightly on her forearm. Or it may have been a leaf. Chapter 5. Neither the twins nor Lola knew precisely what led Bryony to abandon the rehearsals. At the time, they did not even know she had. They were doing the sickbed scene, the one in which bedbound Arabella first receives into her garret the prince disguised as the good doctor. And it was going well enough, or no worse than usual, with the twins speaking their lines no more ineptly than before. As for Lola, she didn't wish to dirty her cashmere by lying on the floor, and instead slumped in a chair, and the director could hardly object to that. The older girl entered so fully into the spirit of her own aloof compliance that she felt beyond reproach. One moment, Bryony was giving patient instructions to Jackson, then she paused and frowned, as if about to correct herself, and then she was gone. There was no pivotal moment of creative difference, no storming or flouncing out. She turned away and simply drifted out, as though on her way to the lavatory. The others waited, unaware that the whole project was at an end. The twins thought they had been trying hard, and Jackson in particular, feeling he was still in disgrace in the Tallis household, thought he might begin to rehabilitate himself by pleasing Bryony. While they waited, the boys played football with a wooden brick, and their sister gazed out the window, humming softly to herself. After an immeasurable period of time, she went out into the corridor and along to the end, where there was an open door to an unused bedroom. From here she had a view of the driveway and lake, across which lay a column of shimmering phosphorescence, white-hot from the fierce late-afternoon heat. Against this column, she could just make out Bryony beyond the island temple, standing right by the water's edge. In fact, she may even have been standing in the water. Against such light, it was difficult to tell. She did not look as if she was about to come back. On her way out of the room, Lola noticed by the bed a masculine-looking suitcase of tan leather and heavy straps and faded steamer labels. It reminded her vaguely of her father, and she paused by it and caught the faint sooty scent of a railway carriage. She put her thumb against one of the locks and slid it. The polished metal was cool, and her touch left little patches of shrinking condensation. The clasp startled her as it sprang up with a loud chunky sound. She pushed it back and hurried from the room. There followed more formless time for the cousins. Lola sent the twins down to see if the pool was free. They felt uneasy being there when adults were present. The twins returned to report that Cecilia was there with two other grown-ups, but by now Lola was not in the nursery. She was in her tiny bedroom, arranging her hair in front of a hand mirror propped against the windowsill. The boys lay on her narrow bed and tickled each other and wrestled and made loud howling noises. She could not be bothered to send them to their own room. Now there was no play, and the pool was not available. Unstructured time oppressed them. Homesickness fell upon them when Pierrot said he was hungry. Dinner was hours away, and it would not be proper to go down now and ask for food. Besides, the boys would not go to the kitchen because they were terrified of Betty, whom they had seen on the stairs grimly carrying red rubber sheets toward their room. A little later, the three found themselves back in the nursery, which, apart from the bedrooms, was the only room they felt they had the right to be in. The scuffed blue brick was where they had left it, and everything was as before. They stood about, and Jackson said, "I don't like it here." The simplicity of the remark unhinged his brother, who went by a wall and found something of interest in the skirting board, which he worried with the tip of his shoe. Lola put her arm across his shoulder and said, "It's all right. We'll be going home soon." Her arm was much thinner and lighter than his mother's, and Piero began to sob, but quietly, still mindful of being in a strange house where politeness was all. Jackson was tearful too, but he was still capable of speech. "It won't be soon. You're just saying that. We can't go home anyway." He paused to gather his courage. "It's a divorce." Piero and Lola froze. The word had never been used in front of the children, and never uttered by them. The soft consonants suggested an unthinkable obscenity. The sibilant ending whispered the family's shame. Jackson himself looked distraught as the word left him, but no wishing could bring it back now. And for all he could tell, saying it out loud was as great a crime as the act itself, whatever that was. None of them, including Lola, quite knew. She was advancing on him, her green eyes narrowed like a cat's. "How dare you say that?" "'S true," he mumbled and looked away. He knew that he was in trouble, that he deserved to be in trouble, and he was about to run for it when she seized him by an ear and put her face close to his. "If you hit me," he said quickly, "I'll tell the parents." But he himself had made the invocation useless, a ruined totem of a lost golden age. "You will never, ever use that word again. Do you hear me?" Full of shame, he nodded, and she let him go. The boys had been shocked out of tears, and now Piero, as usual, eager to repair a bad situation, said brightly, "What shall we do now?" "I'm always asking myself that." The tall man in a white suit standing in the doorway may have been there many minutes, long enough to have heard Jackson speak the word, and it was this thought, rather than the shock of his presence, that prevented even Lola from making a response. Did he know about their family? They could only stare and wait to find out. He came toward them and extended his hand. "Paul Marshall." Piero, who was the nearest, took the hand in silence, as did his brother. When it was the girl's turn, she said, "Lola Quincy. This is Jackson, and that's Piero." "What marvellous names you all have. But how am I supposed to tell you two apart?" I'm generally considered more pleasant, Piero said. It was a family joke, a line devised by their father which usually made strangers laugh when they put the question. But this man did not even smile as he said, You must be the cousins from the north. They waited tensely to hear what else he knew, and watched as he walked the length of the nursery's bare boards and stooped to retrieve the brick, which he tossed in the air and caught smartly with a snap of wood against skin. I'm staying in a room along the corridor. I know, Lola said. Auntie Venus's room. Exactly so, her old room. Paul Marshall lowered himself into the armchair lately used by the stricken Arabella. It really was a curious face, with the features scrunched up around the eyebrows and a big empty chin like Desperate Dan's. It was a cruel face, but his manner was pleasant, and this was an attractive combination, Lola thought. He settled his trouser creases as he looked from Quincy to Quincy. Lola's attention was drawn to the black-and-white leather of his brogues, and he was aware of her admiring them and waggled one foot to a rhythm in his head. I'm sorry to hear about your play. The twins moved closer together, prompted from below the threshold of awareness to close ranks by the consideration that if he knew more than they did about the rehearsals, he must know a great deal besides. Jackson spoke from the heart of their concern. Do you know our parents? Mr. and Mrs. Quincy? Yes. I've read about them in the paper. The boys stared at him as they absorbed this and could not speak, for they knew that the business of newspapers was momentous. Earthquakes and train crashes, what the government and nations did from day to day, and whether more money should be spent on guns in case Hitler attacked England. They were awed, but not completely surprised, that their own disaster should rank with these godly affairs. This had the ring of confirming truth. To steady herself, Lola put her hands on her hips. Her heart was beating painfully hard, and she could not trust herself to speak, even though she knew she had to. She thought a game was being played, which she did not understand, but she was certain there had been an impropriety or even an insult. Her voice gave out when she began, and she was obliged to clear her throat and start again. What if you read about them? He raised his eyebrows, which were thick and fused together, and blew a dismissive, blubbery sound through his lips. Oh, I don't know, nothing at all. Silly things. Then I'll thank you not to talk about them in front of the children. It was a construction she must have once overheard, and she had uttered it in blind faith, like an apprentice mouthing the incantation of a magus. It appeared to work. Marshall winced in acknowledgement of his error and leaned toward the twins. Now you two listen carefully to me. It's clear to everybody that your parents are absolutely wonderful people who love you very much and think about you all the time. Jackson and Piero nodded in solemn agreement. Job done. Marshall turned his attention back to Lola. After two strong gin cocktails in the drawing room with Leon and his sister, Marshall had come upstairs to find his room, unpack and change for dinner. Without removing his shoes, he had stretched out on the enormous four-poster and, soothed by the country silence, the drinks and the early evening warmth, dropped away into a light sleep in which his young sisters had appeared, all four of them standing around his bedside, prattling and touching and pulling at his clothes. He woke, hot across his chest and throat, uncomfortably aroused and briefly confused about his surroundings. It was while he was sitting on the edge of his bed, drinking water, that he heard the voices that must have prompted his dream. When he went along the creaky corridor and entered the nursery, he had seen three children. Now he saw that the girl was almost a young woman, poised and imperious, quite the little Pre-Raphaelite princess with her bangles and tresses, her painted nails and velvet choker. He said to her, "You've jolly good taste in clothes. Those trousers suit you especially well, I think." She was pleased rather than embarrassed, and her fingers lightly brushed the fabric where it ballooned out across her narrow hips. "We got them in Liberty's when my mother brought me to London to see a show."
"And what did you see?"
"Hamlet." They had, in fact, seen a matinee pantomime at the London Pavilion, during which Lola had spilled a strawberry drink down her frock, and Liberty's was right across the street.
"One of my favourites," Paul said.
It was fortunate for her that he, too, had neither read nor seen the play, having studied chemistry. But he was able to say musingly, "To be or not to be?"
"That is the question," she agreed. "And I like your shoes."
He tilted his foot to examine the craftsmanship.
"Yes, duckers in the turl. They make a wooden thingy of your foot and keep it on a shelf forever. Thousands of them down in a basement room, and most of the people are long dead."
"How simply awful."
"I'm hungry," Pierrot said again.
"Ah, well,"
Paul Marshall said, patting his pocket.
"I've got something to show you if you can guess what I do for a living."
"You're a singer," Lola said. "At least you have a nice voice."
"Kind, but wrong. Do you know, you remind me of my favourite sister."
Jackson interrupted.
"You make chocolates in a factory."
Before too much glory could be heaped upon his brother, Pierrot added,
"We heard you talking at the pool."
"Not a guess, then."
He drew from his pocket a rectangular bar wrapped in greaseproof paper and measuring about 4 inches by one. He placed it on his lap and carefully unwrapped it and held it up for their inspection. Politely, they moved nearer. It had a smooth shell of drab green against which he clicked his fingernail.
"Sugar casing, see? Milk chocolate inside. Good for any conditions, even if it melts."
He held his hand higher and tightened his grip, and they could see the tremor in his fingers exaggerated by the bar.
"There'll be one of these inside the kit bag of every soldier in the land. Standard issue."
The twins looked at each other. They knew that an adult had no business with sweets.
Pierrot said, "Soldiers don't eat chocolate."
His brother added,
"They like cigarettes."
"And anyway, why should they all get free sweets and not the children?"
"Because they'll be fighting for their country."
"Our dad says there isn't going to be a war."
"Well, he's wrong."
Marshall sounded a little testy, and Lola said reassuringly,
"Perhaps there will be one."
He smiled up at her.
"We're calling it the Army Ammo."
"Ammo amass a mat," she said.
"Exactly."
Jackson said, "I don't see why everything you buy has to end in O."
"It's really boring," Pierrot said, "like polo and aero, and oxo and brillo."
"I think what they're trying to tell me," Paul Marshall said to Lola as he presented her the bar, "is that they don't want any."
She took it solemnly, and then, for the twins, gave a serves-you-right look. They knew this was so. They could hardly plead for ammo now. They watched her tongue turn green as it curled around the edges of the candy casing. Paul Marshall sat back in the armchair, watching her closely over the steeple he made with his hands in front of his face. He crossed and uncrossed his legs. Then he took a deep breath.
"Bite it," he said softly. "You've got to bite it."
It cracked loudly as it yielded to her unblemished incisors, and there was revealed the white edge of the sugar shell and the dark chocolate beneath it. It was then that they heard a woman calling up the stairs from the floor below. And then she called again, more insistently, from just along the corridor. And this time the twins recognized the voice, and a look of sudden bewilderment passed between them. Lola was laughing through her mouthful of ammo.
"There's Betty looking for you. Bath time. Run along now. Run along."
Chapter 6. Not long after lunch, once she was assured that her sister's children and Bryony had eaten sensibly and would keep their promise to stay away from the pool for at least 2 hours, Emily Tallis had withdrawn from the white glare of the afternoon's heat to a cool and darkened bedroom. She was not in pain, not yet, but she was retreating before its threat. There were illuminated points in her vision, little pinpricks, as though the worn fabric of the visible world was being held up against a far brighter light. She felt in the top right corner of her brain a heaviness, the inert body weight of some curled and sleeping animal. But when she touched her head and pressed, the presence disappeared from the coordinates of actual space. Now it was in the top right corner of her mind, and in her imagination she could stand on tiptoe and raise her right hand to it. It was important, however, not to provoke it. Once this lazy creature moved from the peripheries to the centre, then the knifing pains would obliterate all thought, and there would be no chance of dining with Leon and the family tonight. It bore her no malice, this animal. It was indifferent to her misery. It would move as a caged panther might, because it was awake, out of boredom, for the sake of movement itself, or for no reason at all, and with no awareness. She lay supine on her bed without a pillow, a glass of water within easy reach, and at her side a book she knew she could not read. A long, blurred strip of daylight reflected on the ceiling above the pelmet was all that broke the darkness. She lay rigidly apprehensive, held at knife point, knowing that fear would not let her sleep and that her only hope was in keeping still. She thought of the vast heat that rose above the house and park and lay across the home counties like smoke, suffocating the farms and towns, and she thought of the baking railway tracks that were bringing Leon and his friend, and the roasting black-roofed carriage in which they would sit by an open window. She had ordered a roast for this evening, and it would be too stifling to eat. She heard the house creak as it expanded. Or were the rafters and posts drying out and contracting against the masonry? Shrinking. Everything was shrinking. Leon's prospects, for example, diminishing by the year as he refused the offer of a leg up from his father, the chance of something decent in the civil service, preferring instead to be the humblest soul in a private bank and living for the weekends and his rowing eight. She could be angrier with him if he were not so sweet-natured and content and surrounded by successful friends. Too handsome, too popular, no sting of unhappiness and ambition. One day he might bring home a friend for Cecilia to marry, if 3 years at Girton had not made her an impossible prospect, with her pretensions to solitude and smoking in the bedroom, and her improbable nostalgia for a time barely concluded, and for those fat girls in glasses from New Zealand with whom she had shared a set, or was it a jip? The cosy jargon of Cecilia's Cambridge, the halls, the maids dancing, the little girl, and all the self-adoring slumming, the knickers drying before the electric fire, and two to a hairbrush, made Emily Tallis a little cross, though not remotely jealous. She had been educated at home until the age of 16, and was sent to Switzerland for 2 years, which were shortened to one for economy, and she knew for a fact that the whole performance, Women at the Varsity, was childish, really, at best an innocent lark, like the girls' rowing eight, a little posturing alongside their brothers dressed up in the solemnity of social progress. They weren't even awarding girls proper degrees. When Cecilia came home in July with her finals result,
the nerve of the girl to be disappointed with it. She had no job or skill, and still had a husband to find, a motherhood to confront. And what but her blue stocking teachers, the ones with silly nicknames and fearsome reputations, have to tell her about that? Those self-important women gained local immortality for the blandest, the most timid of eccentricities. Walking a cat on a dog's lead, riding about on a man's bike, being seen with a sandwich in the street. A generation later, these silly, ignorant ladies would be long dead and still revered at high table and spoken of in lowered voices. Feeling the black-furred creature begin to stir, Emily let her thoughts move away from her eldest daughter and sent the tendrils of a worrying disposition out toward her youngest. Poor darling Bryony, the softest little thing, doing her all to entertain her hard-bitten, wiry cousins with the play she had written from her heart. To love her was to be soothed. But how to protect her against failure, against that Lola, the incarnation of Emily's youngest sister, who had been just as precocious and scheming at that age, and who had recently plotted her way out of a marriage into what she wanted everyone to call a nervous breakdown. She could not afford to let Hermione into her thoughts. Instead, Emily, breathing quietly in the darkness, gauged the state of the household by straining to listen. In her condition, this was the only contribution she could make. She rested her palm against her forehead and heard another tick as the building shrank tighter. From far below came a metallic clang, a falling saucepan lid, perhaps. The pointless roast dinner was in the earliest stages of preparation. From upstairs, the thud of feet on floorboards and children's voices, two or three at least, talking at once, rising, falling, and rising again, perhaps in dissent, perhaps excited agreement. The nursery was on the floor above, and only one room along. The Trials of Arabella. If she were not so ill, she would go up now and supervise or help, for it was too much for them, she knew. Illness had stopped her giving her children all a mother should. Sensing this, they had always called her by her first name. Cecilia should lend a hand, but she was too wrapped up in herself, too much the intellectual to bother with children. Emily successfully resisted the pursuit of this line and seemed to drift away then, not quite into sleep, but out of thought, into invalid nullity. And many minutes passed until she heard in the hallway outside her bedroom footfalls on the stairs, and by the muffled sound of them, thought they must be barefoot, and therefore Bryony's. The girl would not wear her shoes in the hot weather. Minutes later, from the nursery again, energetic scuffling and something hard rattling across the floorboards. The rehearsals had disintegrated. Bryony had retreated in a sulk, the twins were fooling about, and Lola, if she was as much like her mother as Emily believed, would be tranquil and triumphant.
This ends Disc 2. Atonement, Disc 3.
Habitual fretting about her children, her husband, her sister, the help, had rubbed her senses raw. Migraine, mother love, and over the years, many hours of lying still on her bed, had distilled from this sensitivity a sixth sense, a tentacular awareness that reached out from the dimness and moved through the house unseen and all-knowing. Only the truth came back to her for what she knew, she knew. The indistinct murmur of voices heard through a carpeted floor surpassed in clarity a typed-up transcript. A conversation that penetrated a wall, or better, two walls, came stripped of all but its essential twists and nuances. What to others would have been a muffling was to her alert senses, which were fine-tuned, like the cat's whiskers of an old wireless, an almost unbearable amplification. She lay in the dark and knew everything. The less she was able to do, the more she was aware. But though she sometimes longed to rise up and intervene,
especially if she thought Bryony was in need of her, the fear of pain kept her in place. At worst, unrestrained, a matching set of sharpened kitchen knives would be drawn across her optic nerve,